KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, March 30, 2006, for broadcast at this time. On today's program, we'll hear a debate between two of the Republican candidates for nomination for the Senate seat currently held by Democrat Ben Nelson, David Kramer, and Pete Ricketts. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KIOS-FM, the Omaha Public School District, or the Omaha Press Club. Here now to introduce the program is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. I'm Gary Kerr, chairman of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. At least once a month, the Press Club sponsors a noon forum on a subject that we think will be of interest to our members and the general public. These forums are open to the public. You do not have to be a Press Club member to attend. Our forum today is a debate involving two of the Republican candidates for the U.S. Senate from Nebraska, David Kramer and Pete Ricketts. A third candidate, Don Stenberg, chose not to participate. Just a little background on that. In early March, candidates Kramer and Ricketts agreed to a debate today here at the Press Club. Don Stenberg said he would debate only if all three of them signed a pledge that, among other things, contained these words, that the candidates will not, quote, make any reference to each other in any paid television, radio, print, direct mail, or other advertising. Pete Ricketts and Dave Kramer said they could not sign a pledge containing those words, and so Mr. Stenberg is not here. Please welcome to the podiums the two that are here, David Kramer and Pete Ricketts. Each of the candidates will get 1 minute and 30 seconds to respond to each question, plus 30 seconds of rebuttal time. The questions were prepared by the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee. Republicans are in control of the White House and Congress, have been, and unless there are some big changes in the fall, congressional elections probably will continue to be. Although in control, there are some deep divisions within the Republican Party itself on a whole range of issues. Several of our questions will be asked in that context. So let's begin. Immigration. You have seen the protests to Congress's efforts to get tough on illegal immigration. Other legislation seeks to provide a path for illegal immigrants to eventually gain U.S. citizenship. Many conservative Republicans see that approach as rewarding illegal entry into the United States. Many Republican business people, on the other hand, don't want to see anything done that would severely restrict their ability to hire people for jobs they say Americans don't want. Which Republican are you in that debate? Pete Ricketts, you have a minute and 30 seconds.
Well, first I'd like to start off by thanking the Omaha Press Club for hosting the forum here today. My lovely wife, Suzanne, and our family, without whose love and support, none of this would be possible. And to Dave Kramer for participating, because it's critical that Nebraskans know where we stand on the issues that are facing us. I've had a chance to travel around this great state. I've visited 92 counties, and I know that Nebraskans are looking for conservative change. And so when we talk about issues like immigration, the first thing we have to address is securing our borders. You know, in business, if you've got a problem, the first thing you do is to stop that problem from getting worse. And so we need to control our border. That means hiring more Border Patrol agents and leveraging technologies. You know, at Ameritrade, we handled millions of accounts with only a couple thousand people. And we did that because we leveraged technology. And remember, this is not just going to be about illegal immigration. It's also about terrorism and about methamphetamine. It also means our northern border as well. Remember, the man who tried to blow up LAX Airport came to us from Canada. And, of course, 80 to 90% of our methamphetamine comes from Mexico here in this state. So our absolute top priority has got to be to secure the border. And then we can need a comprehensive solution to address the 11 million illegal immigrants that are here already, our employers, and the other folks, that the other aspects of the immigration issue.
David Kramer, a minute 30.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you to the members of the Omaha Press Club, to KIOS, and to KXBO for their sponsorship today. Immigration is an issue that's very, very important to me. I am actually the son of an immigrant, which I think makes me uniquely qualified to talk about immigration in this campaign. My mother came to this country from the Republic of Panama at the age of 16, and she instilled in me certain values that I think are critical as we address the issue of and the debate over immigration. I think the problem we have today in Washington is that the approach tends to be piecemeal in nature and knee-jerk. And we have a United States Senator today in Ben Nelson who has proposed just such a knee-jerk reaction. I've taken the time to put forward a comprehensive program with respect and a proposal with respect to immigration. It's comprised of four separate parts. The first is the question of securing our borders, which is critically important. And securing our borders doesn't mean just building a fence or a wall along the southern border. It means addressing concerns that we have with respect to what goes on between our legal points of entry. And if you look back at 9/11, all of the people who attacked us came in through our legal points of entry. The second component of the plan is to address what we're going to do with the 8.5 to 11 million illegal immigrants that live in this country today. The third component of the plan is to fashion a policy going forward that makes sense so we're not in this problem 30 years from now. And the last component is to ensure that we address the root cause of this issue, and that's the economic disparity of opportunity between the countries of origin and the opportunities available in this country.
Pete Ricketts, you have another 30 seconds.
We talked about having a comprehensive solution about what we need to do to address illegal immigration. Amnesty is not a solution. We need to enforce our laws. We also need to enforce our laws on our employers today. Many employers I talk to say, hey, I didn't know the person was illegal. They had false documentation. So we need to roll out programs like the basic pilot program to allow people to check Social Security numbers. And we need to reform the process of illegal immigration. It's painful and expensive to become a citizen today, and we're keeping out the wrong people. We want to let in.
David Kramer.
Thank you, Gary. Immigration policy in this country today, I think, is backwards. Frankly, the people who make every effort to comply with our laws find nothing but obstacles, and the people who make no efforts to comply with our laws find no obstacles at all. I think immigration needs to be based on the concept of assimilation, encouraging people who want to come to this country, who want to learn to speak English and embrace the concept of being an American. That's one of the reasons why I opposed the president's proposal with respect to a guest worker program. I think it sends the wrong message. We want to have people who want to come to this country, put down roots, and invest in our communities and invest in America.
Next question, Iraq. More than 2,300 Americans have been killed. Billions of dollars are being spent each month. President Bush says we must stay the course, even if U.S. troops can't be removed before the next president takes office. Are you a stay-the-course Republican or a Republican like Representative John Murtha of Pennsylvania, the decorated Vietnam vet who says we must get out now, or are you somewhere in between? Mr. Kramer?
I am running as a strong supporter of the war on terror. I believe that we are far better off fighting the terrorists in Kandahar and Baghdad than we are in Kansas City and Boston. I believe that we must be steadfast in our resolve. But steadfast in our resolve does not, in my mind, mean stay the course. We have to approach this much the same way that we do in business, that we do in regular life, and that is we have to evaluate what our goals and objectives are, first and foremost. And I think our goals and objectives in Iraq and Afghanistan are twofold. First, to empower them to govern themselves. Second, to empower them to defend themselves. When we've accomplished both of those goals, then we should come home, and not a day sooner. But in the meantime, I think we have to continue to evaluate the strategies and the tactics that we use to achieve those goals, to ensure that we're doing everything we can to achieve victory and be able to come home. Last but not least, I think we have to do everything we can to support our men and women in uniform. We have people who are today are making huge sacrifices so that we can enjoy the freedoms that we have and many of us take for granted. We have to provide all of the resources necessary so they have the tools, the armaments, and the resources to do their job effectively, safely, and they can come home safe. And they can come home as soon as possible. Thank you.
Mr. Ricketts, a minute 30.
The number one job of the President of the United States is to defend our country. And I absolutely support the President's effort to do that, and our troops that are over in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you look at the situation, we are winning that war there. And there's three fronts we're fighting on. The first is the security front. And we've trained over 200,000 Iraqi troops. And the Tal Afar province is now in the hands of Iraqi security. And during the Golden Mosque bombing, we saw those troops turn out, and there was not one instance of secular violence within those battalions, and not one civilian was killed because of that action. We also need to look at the political front. We've had three free elections with 70% turnout. We haven't had 70% turnout in this state ever. And then on the economic front, the electricity demand in Iraq has doubled. 70% of the people in Iraq think they're going to be better off this year than they were last year. We are making progress in all those fronts. Are there things that we can improve upon? Absolutely. You know, at Ameritrade, we are the low-cost provider of clearing and executing trades. We never found a way to stop reducing costs. Yes, we can improve it. But the decisions on how we manage that war need to come from the folks who are on the ground. We cannot micromanage this war from Washington. It needs to be made by the people who are on the ground and who are the experts.
David Kramer, 30 seconds.
I think the first thing we have to do is remember that this is not the war that we were fighting 3 years ago. We were fighting the Iraqi government at that time, and today we are fighting a bunch of terrorists who've come into Iraq. The second thing is, I bring a unique experience to the table in this race, one that no one else has got, in that I've lived and worked in developing countries around the world, helping them transition from war-torn countries to becoming free market democracies. And I want to bring that firsthand experience to Washington and helping develop the policies that we're going to utilize in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in other countries around the world. Thank you.
Mr. Ricketts?
We have a historic opportunity to bring democracy to the Middle East, and we must do that. There are 300 million people in 22 countries in the Middle East living on an economy half the size of California. And we have a model for how this works. It's called Europe. And it was the Cold War. And it took 50 years. But we saw those people in Eastern Europe see what they could have in Western Europe and threw off their communist tyrants. Iraq can be that beacon of hope in the Middle East.
It was in Iraq that the Bush administration claimed to exercise its preemptive strike doctrine. Hit them first, even though they're doing what they're doing may be only a threat, not actual operations against the U.S. The potential nuclear threat from Iran and North Korea come to mind. Do you believe in preemptive strikes? Pete Ricketts?
Again, the number one role of the president is to defend the country in a time of war, or defend the country whenever. Today's weapons are far too destructive and too dangerous for us to take a wait-and-see attitude. If we have reasonable expectations that somebody's going to strike at us with a nuclear weapon, chemical weapon, or biological weapon, we absolutely need to be taking our country's security in mind and attacking those people first and preventing that attack from happening in the first place. Securing our nation is absolutely important, and we need to be thinking about that in every aspect, whether it's going to be military or how we're, you know, passing the Patriot Act, for instance, to give our law enforcement the tools to be able to connect the dots and find those terrorists before they can make a strike at us.
David Kramer.
The United States has a unique role to play in the world. We have been the leader for generations now in terms of bringing democracy and economic development and opportunity all around the world. And I think, and I believe absolutely, that it's within our right to use preemptive force when we believe we face a threat of national security to the United States. And I'll support the president as long as he reaches that conclusion, and that we do as well. I think there are some parameters, though, on approaching this. I think we have to do everything we can to encourage the international community to support us in these areas. And we've seen some of the things that are going on in North Korea, for example, where the North Koreans have demanded unilateral talks with the United States, but we've refused in an effort to engage the Chinese and the Japanese and the South Koreans and other interested parties in the region. With respect to Iran, having the French and the Germans and the Brits and the Russians involved in helping stem the growth of these weapons of mass destruction is critically important. We have a leadership role to play in the world in building international community, international alliances, to help ensure that not only the United States' safety is preserved, but that of the rest of the world. But if at any time it comes to a question of whether or not the United States' security is at risk, I will err on the side of preemptive attacks in order to preserve our and defend our sovereignty.
Pete Ricketts, you have 30 seconds.
I don't think I have anything further to add.
David?
Agreed.
Okay. One more question on national security. How much privacy are you willing to give up in the interests of national security? Do you think it's okay for government to monitor your emails and telephone conversations? Mr. Kramer?
I think it's a delicate balance that we have to strike. And it's our job as citizens to continually monitor and ensure that our government doesn't cross the line. And at a time of war, it's a different line than it is in a time of peace. I support the Patriot Act, and I support the President with respect to monitoring of telephone conversations and emails in the following arena. If there are calls and information that's going internationally, I don't believe there's any right to have that protected. If it's going on internationally, completely outside the United States of America, I don't believe it should be protected. But if the conversations and the emails and the exchange of information is occurring entirely within the United States of America, I believe we have constitutional provisions in place and statutory provisions in place that would require us to take a higher level of scrutiny for that kind of conduct. And so I would support that kind of activity in those three parameters.
Pete Ricketts?
We do have protections for the citizens of this country that if we are calling each other or emailing each other, the government has to get a court order to be able to take a look at that. When you're looking at things like the Patriot Act, we need to protect our country, and we need to be proactive about that. And the Patriot Act only gave our law enforcement the tools to be able to connect those dots, the same sorts of tools they already had to fight medical malpractice or medical insurance fraud and drug trafficking. So we absolutely needed to pass the Patriot Act to be able to protect ourselves. And when you're talking about surveillance programs going on outside the country, again, if somebody is trying to harm us, we need to monitor that. There were terrorists that were picked up in Italy because of a surveillance program there. And it's not clear to me why a terrorist here in the United States would have an expectation of privacy. So we absolutely need to pursue those people, apprehend them, and keep our country safe.
Mr. Kramer, 30 seconds.
I've said enough.
You said enough? 30 seconds if you want it. No?
I think we're done.
All right. Global warming. The United States gets most of the criticism because of its emissions of greenhouse gases. Is it, in your view, as much of a threat as many people seem to believe it is? And if so, what should be done? Pete Ricketts?
Certainly one of the things that we need to be thinking about as concerned citizens of this country and of the world is how are we going to leave this world to the next generation? And we don't have to look back too many years to see that we haven't always done a good job of taking care of this planet. So we absolutely need to take care of this planet. But it must be done in a way that has good scientific foundation behind the regulations that we create. Because regulations create barriers to business and our success. We need to have that tax base out there, the businesses that employ people, that create the jobs, that allow us to do the things we want to do with our country. And so whenever we think about environmental regulation, it should always be balanced off with good science and how do we approach it. You know, if you're thinking about global warming, we know that the world is warming, but we don't know why. So we need to continue to monitor that and do the scientific research. And we shouldn't be locking ourselves into treaties that could potentially hurt the growth of our nation and our economy. We always need to remember there's going to be a balance, whether it's global warming or how we treat, you know, the folks that are here, our producers in this state, with regard to environmental regulations. So that's what we always need to keep in mind when we're talking about this.
David Kramer, minute 30.
I don't think there's any question that we as human beings are having an impact on our environment. And our task as citizens of this country and of the world is to do everything we can to ensure that we leave this place in better shape than when she was passed on to us. Having said that, just this last Friday, I put a comprehensive energy plan on the table, and one of the components that we talked about in the energy plan was dealing with the issue of global warming. I reject flatly the Kyoto Protocol, because I think it's based on a false premise, and the structure of it is designed to punish those industrialized nations while not harming the developing nations around the world. And the great irony of that proposal is that in the course of the next 20 years, the developing nations will produce far more emissions than would be saved by restricting the ability of the developed nations to continue to do what they're doing. Since 1970 in this country, we've reduced emissions of the six major pollutants by more than 42% by empowering the business sector, the private sector, and encouraging them to do everything they can to produce fuel in particular in a more clean and efficient way. And I would continue to encourage the private sector to increase the technological investment, do everything they can so that we can continue to live in this world and do so in an environmentally responsible and friendly way.
Pete Ricketts, 30 seconds.
When we're thinking about the environment as well, we need to think about energy. The two are interrelated. One of the things we did back in the 1990s is we put on strict regulations about the gasoline we're going to use and where we could drill for oil here in this country. We closed off about 85% of our continental shelf at a time when gasoline or oil was $2 a barrel and gas was something like $2 for 1,000 cubic feet. Well, that's obviously changed right now. So we need to take a look at opening up opportunities like ANWR to be able to reduce fuel costs here domestically.
David Kramer.
Well, when it comes to the issue of emissions, clearly it is an energy-related question. I hope that we'll get a chance to chat about it a little bit broader. Pete and I are in agreement, and frankly, I disagree very strongly. I think this will be a great point of distinction with Senator Nelson in terms of maximizing the resources that we have available to us in this country. He's voted three times in the last year to stop us from being able to do that, and when I serve Nebraska in the United States Senate, I will take the lead in solving this problem, among many others.
Next question. The national debt. Last week, the Republican Senate voted to raise the debt ceiling to a high of nearly $9 trillion, then passed a record $2.8 trillion budget. The debt limit has risen by more than $3 trillion since Republican President Bush took office. To some people, much more is made of the national debt than should be, but many conservative Republicans are said to be appalled. Are you appalled, or is this something that over time can be taken care of and is not a big deal? Mr. Kramer?
Well, I'm appalled, and I'm appalled because I think the Republican Party in Washington has lost its roots. In 1994, when the Republicans took control of the United States House of Representatives and the Senate, they ran as being the party of fiscal responsibility, as being the party of term limits, as being the party of small government. And from 1994 to 2000, they did a pretty darn good job, keeping growth in government to a rate of about 3.4% a year. Since 2001 to the present, though, federal government spending has grown at a rate of almost 7%. And the dirty little secret is that it isn't because of the war on terror, it isn't because of Homeland Security, it's because discretionary spending continues to outpace the rate of growth. We don't have a revenue problem in Washington. The president's tax cuts, which I would support and which I would make permanent, resulted in a revenue increase of 15% last year. What Congress has is a spending problem. And as a result of that, I've put a comprehensive plan on the table to propose both specific structural changes to our system as well as specific spending cuts, including a constitutional amendment to provide for a balanced budget, constitutional amendment to provide for a line item veto, asking the president to exercise his rescission authority. I would propose the repeal of the prescription drug benefit and No Child Left Behind plans, and I would take a strong lead in Washington to make sure that we do, as government, what you and I have to do every day in our households, and that's live within our means.
Pete Ricketts?
As I've made my way around the state and talked to folks, the number one thing people talk to me about are taxes and spending. It's by far the biggest issue that people bring up to me as we've gotten around the state. I bring a different skill set and experience to this race. I'm a businessman. I'm a problem solver. And at Ameritrade, we always had a cost-conscious culture. And during the hard times, like in the dot-com bust in 2000 and 2001, we had to go into our $500 million budget, line item by line item, and make some tough choices because our revenue had been cut so severely. We didn't have the option of raising our prices. We had to cut the budget. And so those are some of the experiences that I've had and the tough decisions we've had to make at Ameritrade to be able to control budgets. And that's exactly the same kind of financial discipline we need today in the federal government. Now, one of the things that we learned at Ameritrade is when you're pointing fingers, you didn't solve problems. So what we have to ask ourselves is, where do we want to go from here? Where are we taking the country? We need to control our spending. And that's something, with my experience at Ameritrade, that I've done. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm getting in this race, is that I can make a difference in Washington to bring conservative change and help control that spending.
David Kramer, 30 seconds.
Pete, if you spend money in Washington the way you've spent money on your campaign, I don't think we can afford to have you in Washington. I think that I've spent my life being an advocate in a lot of different organizations for fiscal responsibility. And I think there's a tremendous opportunity for leadership in Washington on this issue. That's why I've put comprehensive issues on the table. That's why I've identified specific spending cuts. That's why I've proposed the elimination of earmarks. That's why I've proposed bringing transparency to our government, which we lack today. Thank you.
Pete Ricketts, I get a feeling you're going to want to say something.
I'll probably go ahead. Last month, when we filed with the Secretary of State, we unveiled my vision for fiscal responsibility for the country. And it had three aspects. First was reforming the spending process, including doing away with earmarks. The second was prioritizing our spending. The things that we may have been spending on in the past are not necessarily the things that we can spend on in the future. And the third is tax relief, because it's good for all of us. There's this myth that if you cut taxes, you cut revenue, but it's absolutely not true. When we cut taxes, we create jobs, and the single biggest thing you can do for anyone is give them a job.
Next question, farm policy. President Bush and his Republican Secretary of Agriculture, former Nebraska Governor Mike Johanns, want to sharply reduce, perhaps even eliminate, federal payments that go to farmers who grow certain crops. But critics say that if you want to see rural Nebraska further depopulated, just take away those farm subsidies because they are the survival for a lot of farmers. What is the best course? Pete Ricketts?
I'm a fourth-generation Nebraskan. My grandpa was a farmer. I have cousins that are still in farming. As we've made our way around the state, I've talked to a lot of farmers and ranchers. And so I know their concerns about what are we going to do in rural America to keep it strong. And we have an opportunity here with the 2007 Farm Bill to be able to make some changes that will turn us from the Depression-era programs of the past to looking forward to the 21st century. We talked about things such as expanding crop insurance and rural economic development. Let me talk about that for just a moment. 25% of the people here in Nebraska are employed in microenterprise, five people or less. And if you think about, my grandfather farmed 400 acres, and now one of my cousins farms 1,500 acres. In the space of one generation, we've seen a fourfold increase in productivity. If we want people to stay in our rural areas, we're going to need to have the jobs. That's why rural economic development is so important. We need to provide our entrepreneurs the training and education, because it's not just good enough to be a good mechanic or tax preparer. You also have to know how to do accounting and bookkeeping and marketing. And so we need to give them the tools to be able to be successful so they can create the jobs in our rural communities.
David Kramer.
This is an issue that is very, very important to me. And I'm the only candidate in this race who's got firsthand experience having lived and worked on a farm. I spent every summer until I was 22 working down in Panama on my grandparents' farm. We had Brahma cattle, and we had row crops, corn, rice, sugarcane, and sorghum. I joke with folks that I've turned a would-be bull into a steer. I know the difference between a heifer and a cow. I've watched our crops burn. I've seen our creeks run dry. I've prayed for rain, and I've ridden on a horse for so long, I never wanted to sit down again. My grandparents were land rich, money poor. Everything they ever made, they put back into the land. And when I go to Washington to represent Nebraska in the reauthorization of the Farm Bill in 2007, I want to bring that firsthand experience. I think the role of the federal government in agriculture is to provide a safety net so that we don't become dependent on other countries for the consumption and for the production of our agricultural goods the way we've become dependent on other countries for the production of our energy resources. I believe that the federal government has a role to play in that, and I will take a lead and an advocate in that process. When I serve in the United States Senate, I will propose and request to be seated on the Agriculture Committee and on the Agriculture Appropriations Subcommittee to ensure that Nebraskans not only have an advocate at the table, but someone who is going to be a strong voice for agriculture as we go forward.
Pete Ricketts, 30 seconds.
There's a couple of other areas that we need to focus on as well. We need to continue to promote ethanol. Ethanol is a win-win for the state and for the country. It's a clean, renewable source of energy that stretches a non-renewable source of energy and makes us less dependent on foreign oil. 25% of our crop here of corn in Nebraska goes to ethanol, and the industry expects to double in capacity over the next few years because of demand. So we need to do things like in 2010 continue to have the tax break for ethanol. We also need to have free and fair trade, open up opportunities for our producers. Our agricultural producers face bigger bigger tariffs when they export versus what their competitors overseas do.
David Kramer.
Well, I've had the opportunity to live and work internationally. And in so doing, I've had the opportunity to understand that 96% of the goods of the the consumers in the world live outside the United States of America. I understand the interrelationship between U.S. foreign policy and the policies of other countries, and the role that we have to play, A, as a Congress, and B, as a country in terms of advocating at the World Trade Organization, to ensure we have access to all of those markets around the world and to ensure that we have a level playing field. It's not just about free trade, it's about fair trade as well.
Where are you on the Republican spectrum? From 1 to 10, 10 being the most conservative, where would you put yourself and why? Mr. Kramer?
Gary, that's a great question. And certainly one I don't think either of us anticipated. Well, at least we didn't. I would probably describe myself as probably an 8, because I have a bit of a civil libertarian streak running through me in terms of what the role of government should be and how intrusive government should be. Now, I've been very, very partisan. That's been one of the knocks on me. And I'm very proud of the fact that I've spent my last 30 years in public service, being active in the Republican Party and lots of other civic and charitable organizations in the community. What I hope that demonstrates is my willingness to stand up and share with people what I believe in and be a strong advocate for them. But I think at the heart of the question is something more important. And really it goes to, what is it that will be the compass that I have in terms of casting decisions when I'm in Washington? And I will always put what's best for America first, what's best for Nebraska first, over what's best for the Republican Party. I've stood up publicly in this race, and I've said on three different occasions that I disagree with the President of the United States. And Senator Nelson will have you believe that whichever one of us is elected in this primary, of course I believe it's going to be me, but that whichever one of us is going to be a lapdog for the President. I don't believe that. I will stand up to the President when I think I disagree with him. I will stand up and share with Nebraskans when I disagree with them. If they think that I'm wrong, I hope that they'll convince me. I'll do my part to convince them. But that's part of leadership in this race, is about leadership. Thank you very much.
Pete Ricketts, where are you on the spectrum?
One of the things that we're going to need today to be able to get things done is to work together. That's certainly something that I learned in business, that you can't get along with folks if you're calling each other names. And I think this labeling process is also part of the problem. It polarizes us. It doesn't bring us together. Somebody famous once said, you know, don't judge men by their intentions, but rather by their actions. And I think that's what the voters in Nebraska should do, is decide who I am based upon the things I've said or the things I've done. You know, where do I stand on issues? I'm absolutely pro-life. I believe that life begins at conception. I've earned the endorsement of Nebraska Right to Life and Nebraskans United for Life. I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. I do believe we need to control government spending and have smaller government and bigger and smaller taxes, lower taxes. That the role of the Constitution was to keep federal government away from the states and not have it get involved in the states. Those are the things that I believe, and I believe that we as Republicans ought to stand for. And so that's the sort of message that I'm taking out there. We've got to reduce taxes and spending. We need to deal with the big issues that we're facing today. And I'll let the voters in Nebraska decide where on that spectrum I fall.
Mr. Kramer, 30 seconds.
I'm running as a pro-life, pro-family, pro-business Republican, and when you ask the voters to decide based on what our actions are, I want them to look, and all you have to do is look out the window here, and you can see on one occasion, if you look at the Quest Center, where I stood up and I put the interests of party aside to do what I thought is for the best of the community. I spent 30 years of my life doing that in this community and in this state, and I want to continue to do that, standing up for what's right, standing up for what's good, and standing up for what will make America a better nation than she is today.
And the next question, and we've already gotten into this, but we're going to get into it again.
Don't I get another one?
He gets 30 seconds. He's got 30 more seconds.
I'm sorry, 30 seconds.
Now I feel like I have to say something. Wasn't going to before. I think the other thing we need to think about in this election is this race may determine who controls the United States Senate, whether it's going to be Democrats or Republicans. And that's a very different philosophy. You know, are we looking to have smaller government? Or are we looking for bigger government? Higher taxes or lower taxes? So we need to be thinking about that when we're making those decisions about who we're going to vote for.
All right, now that question. You're going to get to repeat a lot of what you...
Is this
coming
back to me now?
You're going to get a chance to repeat some of what you've already said. But, Mr. Ricketts, your commercials talk heavily of Nebraska values. What are they? Define them for us. And do you see yourself as different from your opponents when it comes to Nebraska values?
To me, Nebraska values revolve around faith, family, responsibility, hard work, and determination. It means dealing with a problem head on and making tough decisions. As I've made my way around the state, I know that Nebraskans believe in fiscal prudence. And so we're concerned about how the federal government is spending our money. People ask me, why are there horse trails and hiking trails and parking garages in a national transportation bill? Nebraskans know that agriculture is the backbone of our state's economy. So we're concerned about how the federal government is going to create that safety net for our producers and how we're going to expand opportunities so that we can have a farm policy that strengthens our rural communities. And Nebraskans want a safer America. And so we want tighter border security. And we want to protect ourselves from the terrorists and drugs and illegal immigrants. To me, these are very much common sense Nebraska values. They're my values. They're our values. They're Nebraska values. And that's what we need. We need to elect a leader who will work for our Nebraska values in the United States Senate.
David Kramer.
Well, I think we probably are in agreement on the question of what the values are that we share. And frankly, I think that each of the candidates in this race, including he who shall not be named, share the same values. I really think this race, though, isn't so much a question of values, given that all of us share them, as it is about leadership. Leadership, in my mind, isn't keeping all of your options open until the very last minute, waiting to see who's going to win, jumping on board and calling it a victory. Leadership isn't about knowing where you stand with one foot on either side of the fence. It's about knowing what you stand for. Leadership is about being willing to stand up and look Nebraskans in the eye and tell them what you think about the critical issues we face as a nation and what solutions you're going to offer for them in Washington. That's why I believe that I'm the strongest candidate in this race, that I'm the candidate who brings experience in agriculture, in international affairs, in politics, and in business, that I will be the strongest advocate for Nebraska and Washington, that I will be the candidate who has the ability to go to Washington and put together coalitions to get things done. This race is ultimately about who the strongest person is, first of all, to take on Ben Nelson in the fall, but more importantly, who the best person to represent us in the United States Senate. And I believe if you elect me, you'll find that I'm the strongest person.
Pete Ricketts, you have 30 seconds.
When we're thinking about what we want to accomplish, one of the things that got me involved in this race was Social Security reform. It's just math that program is going to run out of money in 2017. And yet, in the State of the Union address, the Democratic caucus got up and stood and applauded when the president said, we haven't gotten anything done on this. We need people who are going to take on problems and deal with them head on. At Ameritrade, we had no choice but to do those sort of things. That's why I want to be your United States Senator.
David Kramer.
I've said enough again.
All right. Health care. Tens of millions of Americans are uninsured because they can't afford the insurance whose costs are driven ever higher by spiraling health care costs. What would you do, David Kramer?
Well, in the coming weeks, I'm going to put forward a comprehensive proposal to address the issue of health care, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security reform. Somebody said to me, you know, Hillary Clinton had the power of the White House behind her, and she couldn't get it done. Why do you think you could? Stay away. Run away from that. I think if you want to be a leader in this state, you've got to put your positions out first and foremost so that the voters get a chance to make a decision for you. And in light of that fact, I'm going to provide the voters of the state of Nebraska with a little bit of information about where I stand on health care. Today, we have a system that is fundamentally broken. And the approach in Washington tends to be knee-jerk in nature, and it tends to be reactionary. And we need to take a comprehensive approach. with respect to health insurance in particular, we are no longer a health insurance society. We've become a prepaid medical. Things that used to never be covered are now mandated by state regulation. We have to introduce competition back into healthcare. I've learned this firsthand. 2 years ago, I had rotator cuff surgery. I couldn't tell you what it cost because I paid the difference between what my insurance company paid and what the doctor in the hospital. But I've since come to learn that you can get an MRI in Omaha for $470 or for $1,470. And until we incent individuals to understand what the cost of health care is, I think it will be very, very difficult for us to be able to reform health care in any sort of a dramatic fashion to make a long-term difference for our nation.
Pete Ricketts, a minute 30.
There are some tactical things that we absolutely need to do to be able to help bring down health care costs. One is allow small businesses to pool their resources through association health care plans. There's a bill before the Senate today that would allow that. The other is to pass medical malpractice tort reform. This is one of the differences between me and Senator Nelson. He's been a part of the filibuster to even prevent this from coming to the floor of the United States Senate. But strategically, we need a complete overhaul of our health care system. We have created a system where almost nobody has any incentive to reduce costs. I mean, if you think about it, if you've got a copay to go see your doctor and it costs $15 or $25, we've just taught you that that doctor's visit costs $15 or $25. In reality, it costs $160 or $180. And now you go to the doctor, and because we don't have tort reform, that doctor's worried about getting sued. So they tell you you need to have all these procedures done to cover, make sure they don't get sued. Well, I've had a physician tell me 40% of the costs in our medical system are because we have unnecessary procedures like that. And then we get a prescription drug. Do we ask if it's generic or brand name? But the average generic drug costs $1,250. But the average brand name drug costs $150. I was talking to a gentleman here in Omaha who actually shopped around for his drugs and found a huge difference just between the vendors here in the city.
Mr. Kramer, 30 seconds.
We have a fundamental problem with our healthcare system, and that today it's a cost shift. The federal government mandates in Medicare and Medicaid provision of certain services, and yet they won't reimburse the providers of those services more than 70 cents on the dollar of what it actually costs them to do. And the result of that is they shift the cost on to those of us who have the financial resources to pay it or the financial resources to purchase insurance. I'm proposing a system that will provide a role for the federal government to play in changing from a defined contribution or defined benefit type of a plan to a defined contribution plan of healthcare in this country.
Pete Ricketts.
I was talking to a woman in David City, and she had breast cancer. And she told me that her drugs ran her $200 a month, and then they came off patent. And it dropped to $36 a month. And then her doctor wrote her another prescription for a brand new drug that cost $250 a month. We've got to start becoming consumers. How do we do that? We start doing that by promoting things like health savings accounts that require us to start taking responsibility for how we judge whether or not we need medical care and what those costs are. We need to have transparency in the pricing. And those are the things, by leveraging the power of the market, that are going to help drive health care costs down.
Next question, and this was referred to briefly, Social Security. It was President Bush's number one domestic priority last year. His plan would give every young worker a private retirement account. It didn't get very far. Do you favor privatizing Social Security? Mr. Ricketts.
As I mentioned before, Social Security is one of the big issues that we're facing in this country. It's one of the things that we feel about ourselves as a nation, that we take care of our elderly. It's probably one of the most successful programs we've ever had in this country, if you look at poverty among seniors in the 30s versus today. But it is just math. It's broken. It's creaking with age and needs to be reformed. Can personal accounts be a part of that solution? Absolutely. Are they the entire solution? No. We need to have a true model that lays out all of our options, like personal accounts, or like the retirement age. Let's take that one for example. You know, back in the 30s, men lived to be an average of 58 years old and women 62, and retirement age was set at 65. The government set up a system they knew they could win, but it's changed. We're older now. We live longer. We live to be 76 or 78, and so we're going to have to take a look at that retirement age and see how we tweak that to be able to get some changes in the solvency. So by adding things like personal accounts, and the retirement age. You can see how that change is going to be done. Total the column at the bottom and see how much difference we've made in Social Security. Then we can have a true dialogue about whether or not we like the plan that's been put before. The problem with the issue last summer was that we had ideas floated around, but we didn't have anything that was concrete that we could really have a national debate about.
David Kramer, a minute 30.
Well, I disagree with you there, Pete, on your last sentence that we didn't have something we could have a national debate about. I think the problem in Washington is that we didn't have leadership. We had a president who stood up and demonstrated his willing to take on an issue that nobody else wanted to take on, and our representatives in Congress ran away from it, including Senator Nelson, who stood up and said, oh, we should focus on the solvency issue first. Ladies and gentlemen, solvency is a red herring. It's language by the Democrats to increase the Social Security tax and the threshold on which they can tax our Social Security as well. And why is that a problem? The problem is that today, the Social Security Administration takes in way more money than they pay out. And where is that money gone? They've spent it. They say it. They sign IOUs. They're not IOUs. They're we owe us. And we're the ones who are going to have to pay for it. Pete, your children and my children, our children and grandchildren, are going to be left saddled with this burden. This is a contract that we made with our citizens. And I believe in order to address Social Security, we have to make fundamental reforms to the system. And I would support personal accounts. I don't believe we should privatize it, but I support personal accounts more than any reason because it puts the money in our own pocket for when we retire. My father is the perfect example. My father died when he was 63 years old. He paid in his whole life. And while my mother gets some small survivor benefit, she'll never get what my father paid in. I support personal accounts, and I think we need to reform Social Security now.
Pete Ricketts for 30 seconds.
You know, you asked about Nebraska values earlier, and taking responsibility for yourself is one of those Nebraska values. And whether it's Social Security or health care, the direction we need to go is to empowering people to manage their own lives. That's why personal accounts are important. It gives people that control, that creates that ownership society. We've seen the expansion of 401ks just because of that, because people start doing that. When it comes to things like Medicare and Medicaid reform, if we can mainstream those folks into private insurance, they'll be happier and we'll get a better deal. It's about giving people control.
David Kramer.
As you look at Social Security, it was never designed to be a retirement plan. It was designed to be a safety net. And it was never actuarially sound. It's been broken from the start. But when we had 16 workers paying in for every worker who came out, it worked. Today, we expect that in 20 years from now, we're going to have 70 cents paid out on the dollar of what's been pledged. And if you walk across the street here to the federal courthouse and you said to a judge, I'll pay you 70 cents on every dollar that I owe, he'll say, you're bankrupt. We've got to fix the problem now.
Next question. Education. President Bush's No Child Left Behind plan is hailed at some quarters, but sharply criticized in others. Do you support No Child Left Behind? David Kramer?
No, I do not support No Child Left Behind. I don't believe that when it comes to the question of education, that one size fits all. You know, there's a great irony about what's going on in Washington today. It used to be that this country was about creating equality of opportunity. Instead, what we're trying to do today is legislate equality of result. The federal government's role when it comes to education ought to be about creating as level a playing field as possible for each child when they present themselves at the door, and that each child should then use his or her own God-given gifts to the best of their ability to achieve what they can achieve. But to mandate that each child has to achieve certain goals and objectives in order for those schools to be deemed acceptable, I don't think it works. I have a great deal of experience in this area, working firsthand with public educational institutions both in Nebraska and in Iowa as they've tried to comply with it. And frankly, the regulatory burden on them, we've doubled federal education spending since 2001, and more than 40% of that money gets lost between Washington and the school classroom. I think we ought to revamp our federal system, become more block grant oriented, give the creative men and women who are serving us in our classrooms the ability to do everything they can. If you look at schools that have dynamic leadership, their test scores, regardless of socioeconomic status, tend to go up. That's the kind of role that the federal government should play, and I would have voted against No Child Left Behind.
Pete Ricketts, what do you think of No Child Left Behind?
I know the importance of education. I'm a product of public education. I went to school, graduated from Westside. Should we be holding our schools accountable for how they teach our students? Absolutely. Should it be done through an unfunded federal mandate that has a one-size-fit-all centralized decision-making idea? Not at all. We've got a long history and tradition in this country of local control of schools, and it served us very, very well. We shouldn't be giving that up to the federal government by allowing them to come in and tell us how we do our schools. I would have voted against No Child Left Behind. There's other issues out there the Department of Education is trying to take on, too. If you look at merit scholarships, for instance, they want to give them out based on merit. Great idea. But what they want to do now is accredit the high schools before they'll give out those merit scholarships. Well, what is that? That's the federal government accrediting our local high schools and telling us how we have to run them. That's not the path we want to go down in this country. We want local controls of our schools. We want to be able to decide here so that we can have those customized approaches that make common sense solutions a reality.
David Kramer, 30 seconds.
Pete, I disagree with you in that it was an unfunded mandate. We've managed to double education spending at the federal level since 2001. Per pupil spending since 1960 has more than doubled as well, and yet the gap in achievement hasn't changed. I think the problem that we face is the approach. We have today more than 100 federal governmental programs that require individual applications and grant processes. We've created so much red tape in our education system that our teachers, our principals, our administrators are having to struggle and spend two, three hours a day just complying with the governmental structure that we've got in place. I think it's broken, and we've got to fix it.
Pete Ricketts?
I was talking to the superintendent of a school in Taylor, and it's a small town, and so they have teachers teaching third grade, eighth grade, and seniors in high school. And part of the requirements for No Child Left Behind that they weren't getting any money for was all the duplicative reports that they had to file to be able to comply with that act. That's not common sense. The solutions that work in Omaha and Lincoln don't work in Taylor, Valentine, or Scotts Bluff. We need to have local control so that we can make the decisions about how we're going to hold our teachers accountable.
One more question, and because of timing, we are going to restrict this to a minute 30 each. What do you believe should be the role of government in our lives? We all agree to the need for national defense, but other than that, should government primarily just get out of the way of the free enterprise system, or does government play an important role in rules and regulations to govern our lives? Mr. Ricketts?
The first role of the federal government is to defend the country. The next role is to create the environment so that we can be successful. That means low taxes, so we don't penalize people for achievement. Low regulations, so we don't put up other obstacles to success. It means building the infrastructure, the roads, or the high-speed internet access. And then to the extent we can, helping our entrepreneurs to succeed. You know, I mentioned the rural economic development and the training and education there. We can also use community development block grants distributed at the local level. I've talked to a number of companies who've benefited from this. RTG Medical in Fremont, Vitalex in Alliance, George Risk Industries in Kimball. George Risk Industries, 30 years ago, was a five-person operation. Today, they employ over 300 people, and they got help expanding through community development block grants. That's a wise way for us to spend our money. We as the federal government should be getting out of the way and empowering the people to take care of themselves. When we set up a new safety net, it should be so that the people can manage how they're going to do that and take care of their decisions on their own. That's the role of the federal government. Smaller government, lower taxes.
David Kramer, we're going to strict you to a minute here. I'm sorry, but we got
time.
Okay. Around.
That's okay. I can, contrary to popular belief, I can probably get it done in a minute. I believe that the role of the federal government should be very limited in terms of its intrusiveness in our life. In my 12 of the last 15 years spent practicing law and representing small businesses and individuals as they've tried to deal with government, I've come to appreciate the fact that government has the ability to encourage business growth, it has the ability to stifle it. And I'm running unabashedly as a strong supporter of business in general and small business in particular. 80% of the new jobs in this country are created by small businesses, and I think that the government ought to get out of business and ought to let people who want to take risks, who want to be entrepreneurs, get out and do that and be successful. With respect to our personal lives, I think that government intrudes in our lives every day at many different levels. We live in a representative form of government, and that we should be constantly vigilant of what role government is playing. I want it to be limited. As I said earlier, I have a little bit of a civil libertarian bent that runs through me, having lived in countries where you didn't have the kinds of freedoms that we had today. I thank you.
It's time now for our closing statements. Each of you have 2 minutes, and David Kramer, your closing statement.
I'd like to...
Excuse me. Pete Ricketts. I messed up. You're
okay,
first on
great.
This.
David was getting ready to go, so I didn't want to...
Go ahead. Get out of the way, right?
Well, thank you again for the chance to speak here today. My wife, Suzanne, and I, and our 3 kids have enjoyed the opportunity to travel our great state and talk to Nebraskans and hear their concerns. Nebraskans want somebody who is going to represent their values. We need to elect a leader that is going to work for Nebraska values of smaller government and lower taxes. We must defeat Ben Nelson because he is a Democrat, and he will be beholden to the Liberal Democratic Caucus, folks like Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, and John Kerry, folks whose values are not in line with most Nebraskans. I can beat Ben Nelson. I bring different experiences and skills to this race. I'm not a career politician or a lawyer. I'm a businessman and a problem solver. And I will use my experience growing a Nebraska company, creating jobs, balancing budgets, to cut wasteful government spending, and to hold the government more accountable to taxpayers. I will work to protect life, encourage responsibility, to promote agriculture and conservative reform to better the quality of life for Nebraska families. I want this 21st century to be an even greater American century, filled with promise of hope for the future, security for our citizens, economic opportunity for everyone, and a culture that respects life and inspires responsibility. That's the Nebraska and the America that I grew up in. Nebraska values make a difference. So, if you like what you heard here today, I ask for your vote. If you really like what you heard here today, go tell all your friends. Thank you very much, and God bless America.
David Kramer.
Well, thank you, Gary. I want to thank the Press Club, KXVO, and KIOS for their sponsorship of this debate. I'd also like to thank my wife, Beth, who is here today. I've been to all 93 counties in Nebraska. Beth and Joshua and Benjamin have been with me to 65 of them. It's been a family adventure, I can assure you, but I couldn't have done this without you. Thank you, honey. I love you very, very much. I want to thank Pete. Running for the United States Senate is very important. And people who want to run for the United States Senate and people who are serious candidates should be willing to stand before the citizens and debate the critical issues we face as a nation without fear that they might jeopardize their perceived front-runner status or that they might jeopardize their entire campaign. I believe that the citizens of the state of Nebraska are great judges of character and of people, and that they will judge us by the way we conduct our campaign and decide whether we did it the right way or the wrong way. I think it's important that you're here. I'm glad that you're here. It's been a great pleasure doing this with you, and I look forward to doing it some more. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm a Republican running for United States Senate to control federal spending and cut taxes, to secure our borders, to safeguard our nation from the threat of terror, and to strengthen us by making us more energy self-sufficient. I'm proud to be running as a pro-life, pro-family, pro-business Republican who has made every effort to travel across the state and introduce myself to Nebraskans the old-fashioned way, one by one. This race is about leadership. And if you want someone who will take the lead in protecting traditional marriage, who will take the lead in securing our borders, who will take the lead in cutting spending and controlling taxes, then I'm your candidate. Ladies and gentlemen, before you go to sleep this evening, I hope you'll stop and take a moment and say a special word of thanks for the men and women in uniform who today, all across the world, are standing guard so that you and I can enjoy the freedoms that so many take for granted. God bless each and every one of you. God bless America, and thank you very much.
That concludes our noon forum in this debate. Thank you both for coming.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a debate between two of the Republican candidates for nomination for the Senate seat currently held by Democrat Ben Nelson, David Kramer, and Pete Ricketts. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, March 30, 2006, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future forums in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.